Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.
One of the things that surprised us is just how crazy people can sometimes go over champagne and how much they crave it.
My grandmother drank champagne pretty much every day, certainly for either lunch or dinner. He said that it stirs the spirit, and it does.
Most people remember the first part of a sentence. I go to bed with a single drop of Chandler number 5 on me. They forgot the second part, which was, and I wake up with a glass of Piper Heidsieck. It warms my body up.
When we launched this bottle, we can say that it has been seen in Champagne, very traditional, like a UFO in the landscape of Champagne.
We use Bollinger being the champagne of James Bond, and we promote the launch of the film in 90 countries.
Right, for a first-time director, it might seem an unusual decision to opt to make that first film about champagne, but that's what Frank Mannion has done. It's called Sparkling, The Story of Champagne, and it's just been released in Ireland. Frank joins us now on News Talk. Good afternoon, Frank.
Good afternoon, Sean. Delighted to be on your show.
How old is champagne?
Well, the first sort of recorded mentions of it are the 5th century, when it was the coronation drink of kings. King Clovis was crowned in Reims Cathedral in the 5th century, and to celebrate they had the local wine, which was champagne, but it wasn't fizzy, it was a red still wine. And in fact, it was a red still wine for centuries. It wasn't until the 18th century that it became the fizzy drink that we know today. But it's always been the drink of celebration for 1600 years.
And the fizziness was for many years regarded as a flaw.
Yes, that's right. So, it's the second fermentation that, you know, provides the sort of effervescence. If the wine is left in barrels over a winter in spring, the spring brings, you know, the yeasts and some fizziness. And so for decades, if not centuries, the champagne winemakers saw this as a flaw and preferred it as a still wine. But when the casks were shipped over to England, the English aristocracy actually encouraged the fizziness and added sugar. So in the 17th century, we discovered documentation showing that the English were fizzing up wine from champagne. And actually, they were fizzing it up long before the so-called father of champagne himself, the Benedictine monk Dom Perignon. So actually, in our film, we go as far as saying that the English have a fair claim to have discovered and popularized sparkling wine sparkling champagne before the French.
Something that I imagine the French mightn't be too keen on.
Well, the film opens next month in France, so we'll know. But Canal Plus, which is the biggest French broadcaster, loves the mischievousness of our idea that the English got there first. So they're going to be unleashing it on an unsuspecting French public next month on French TV. So I'll know whether I can, you know, be allowed back into the country or not then.
Best get a trip in before then. The English used to drink bottles of champagne from pint bottles, is that right?
Well, that's right. I mean, Winston Churchill's favourite champagne was Paul Roger, and he drank at least one pint of champagne. It was an imperial pint back then, but it was made in pint bottles. So it's estimated that he had over 40,000 bottles or pints of champagne in his lifetime. And now that UK has left the strict bottling regulations of the European Union, Paul Roger UK are actually thinking about bringing back the pint of champagne. So it might actually be able to, it might change the order in your local.
Oh, right. My word. And they would be entitled to do that. It would be outside the European Union, so beyond the reach of European or French law.
Well, yes, the English Parliament would have to pass a law allowing bottling of sparkling wine or champagne in a pint form. But I'm sure Boris Johnson would be more than happy to endorse that legislation. No doubt he would be the first customer as well.
Yeah, indeed. Now, and to a degree, though, Frank, is the story of champagne also the story of, and it's not, I'm not taking away from the vineyards or the champagne makers, but it's also a story of marketing. Now, how come it's the sexiest, most glamorous drink in the world as opposed to anything else?
Well, the champagne producers have long been the kings of marketing. You know, present day, the champagne brands spend tens of millions of dollars associating themselves with horse racing, Lanson with Wimbledon, Tattinger with the BAFTAs, and doing celebrity endorsement from the likes of, you know, Roger Federer is the face of Moët to get the sports crowd. Scarlett Johansson used to be the face of Moët. But, you know, each champagne house has a sort of a historical character that really championed the brand. So with Piper Heidsieck, it was Marie Antoinette absolutely adored Piper Heidsieck. So it, again, that royal association of celebration and decadence, you know, going back centuries. Then in the 20th century, you know, Marilyn Monroe was the, you know, undisputed queen of Piper Heidsieck. You know, she reputedly had baths of it at the Beverly Hills Hotel. The Piper Heidsieck still have the receipts of orders that they sent to her bungalow. You know, so historically, it was this incredibly marketed drink. Because it was associated with kings and aristocracy, it was able to be marketed itself as a premium product.
Given, though, that champagne, genuine champagne as opposed to sparkling wine, can only come from the Champagne region, does climate change perhaps threaten its future or the you know, the general availability of it?
Well, you know, the Champagne region for centuries has been overrun by all sorts of foreign invaders, from the Franks, the Goths, the Huns, the Russians drank, you know, invaded, defeated Napoleon, drank and 600,000 bottles of Moët Chandon in the cellars of Epernay. You know, so they're used to, you know, they was on the front line of World War One. So it's used to looking over its shoulder at the next disaster about to happen. And climate change, while not a disaster, is something that they are trying to control. And they're also trying to control it by hedging their bets. So, you know, the Paul Roget and Tattinger have sparkling wine businesses in California and Australia. And in the south of England, the climate is becoming more conducive to the growing of what we would call, you know, champagne grapes.
And there's already a sparkling wine, a fairly larger sparkling wine business in the south of England.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a multi, you know, million pound business. The wine industry there has huge capital investment from rich city investors. The Queen's even got in on the act. She has her own Windsor sparkling wine. Pommery and Tattinger have bought bought land and turned them into vineyards in Kent and Hampshire, because the soil in that area is chalk, just like the chalk soil in Champagne. You know, the White Cliffs of Dover are chalks, you know, they're chalk stacks. So the most visible physical manifestation of a chalk soil that is making the English sparkling wine world something that's, you know, could take the world by storm. And in fact, there's an Irish winemaker, Dermot Sugrue from Kilmallock in Limerick, who has his hands all over several vineyards there. And he's an award-winning winemaker at Whiston Estate and has his own brand, Sugrue South Downs. And he's the grandnephew of Bernard Regan, who set up Shannon Duty Free and popularized the Irish coffee. So he's got alcohol in his veins there.
Frank, thanks a million for speaking with us today. The name of that film is Sparkling, the Story of Champagne.
Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.